KZSU-FM, Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And this coming year, I'll be continuing as a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today, I'm excited to have on a repeat guest, a return guest on Hearsay Culture, a professor Jackie Lipton of University of Akron School of Law, author of the just-released book, Rethinking Cyber Law, A New Vision for Internet Law, published by Elgar Publishing. Jackie, for those of you listening to Hearsay Culture, you hopefully recall, Jackie was on the show a few years ago discussing some of her work in the trademark realm. We are now going to turn to this new work where, as the title suggests, Jackie has, I think appropriately, decided with, roughly about 15 or so years, maybe a little bit longer, of what we call cyber law under our belt. Perhaps we need to reconsider what cyber law in fact is. So this new vision for Internet law is something that I think is certainly helpful in understanding what the cyber law world looks like today. I've taught cyber law as a professor since 2007. Jackie's been teaching it significantly longer than that. But even in the intervening 8 or 9 years since I started teaching in this field, it's changed quite a bit. As Jackie notes in the book, and we're going to talk about it, cyber law started off thinking about some very fundamental issues. Like what is in fact cyber law? Should it exist? There's a famous within the field writing by Judge Frank Easterbrook and by Larry Lessig debating whether cyber law should exist as a field, which remains an interesting question. And then the early questions as far as the law went were things like how should courts get jurisdiction over individuals in cyber law disputes, how are contracts formed, and the like. As Jackie threads the needle in this really interesting and useful study, she identifies two core themes of what she proposes internet law or cyber law should be in 2015, and that's a focus on information and a focus on intermediaries. Information flow plays an enormous role in cyber law or internet law because much of the disputes involving internet law, from copyright infringement to issues related to privacy, are all questions of who has rights to access information, when should information not be shared, how should information be owned, and what should happen from a liability perspective when someone misuses information. Similarly, intermediaries have always played an enormous role in cyber law because we are dealing with platforms of speech, whether it's Google or Yahoo or Facebook or Twitter, and on, you've got these platforms that operate as really the basis of information movement on the internet. But the question becomes, what do we do with these intermediaries from a legal standpoint? Are the intermediaries, for example, speakers? Are they the ones that are speaking when, in fact, someone says or does something that someone else doesn't like on the internet? Should these intermediaries be liable for that speech is a very difficult question. And certainly, as I have taught cyber law or internet law over the last 8 years, I have found, as I mentioned to Jackie in our pre-discussion, not explicitly, but really indirectly coming back to these two core questions. And so I think it's useful that Jackie identifies those two current threads. In the book, Jackie, because her background is in, not exclusively, but heavily in intellectual property, focuses on specific areas within cyber law, particularly copyright law, trademark law, defamation and speech issues, and privacy and cyber victimization. As Jackie notes in the book, those are certainly not the only areas of cyber law, but certainly I think are very useful ways to consider these issues. And so we're going to talk through Jackie's proposal, some of the background issues that she looks at, and kind of talk about the current state of the cyber law community or internet law community today. And I should note quickly, I've said it several times, there is a question of whether cyber law should be called internet law or internet law should be called cyber law or something like that. And if it sounds like semantics, in a sense it is. But from a broader perspective, it really defines what we mean and how we use law in the context of technology. So we'll talk about that as well. By way of very, very brief background, Jackie Lipton holds the David L. Brennan Chair in Law at the University of Akron School of Law. Jackie is someone that I've known for quite a while, someone who previously taught at Case Western where I went to law school, but Jackie was not on the faculty when I was there. But she's certainly an influential scholar and thinker in the cyber law community. She's influenced me as she's influenced many others in the field, and I'm excited to have Jackie back on the show. She's joining us via Skype from Ohio. And we are recording today on July 6, 2015. Jackie, thank you much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks very much for having me. It's great to be back on the show again.
So, Jackie, let's jump in. And for those that aren't as familiar, talk a bit more about your background and why you wrote this book now.
I think there's a lot of reasons I wrote this book now. I was initially a cyber law skeptic. So when cyber law courses started being taught at law schools in the 1990s, I did not teach them. I didn't start teaching until about 2000 in this area. And I was very, very skeptical about whether or not cyber law was a field. And I was very annoyed that my banking law classes were getting very few students while the cyber law professor was getting a huge waiting list for her class. And I couldn't see that there was any there. I was very sort of annoyed about this whole new field. And then, ironically, when I came to Case Western, I was asked to teach the course because no one at the time was teaching it. And that started, I think, a long journey of thinking about, well, really, what is this course? What's it all about? Is there a unifying principle to it? And I don't think I could have written the book until I did, because I really... For one thing, I needed to reflect back on years of thinking about what I thought the course was really about. And for another thing, I don't think there was really enough legislative and judicial development in the early years of the new millennium to really define what the field could be. So I thought it would be interesting to take a retrospective look at now, 15, 20 years after people started talking about cyber law, internet law, to see if there is any there and what, in fact, courts and legislatures have been doing that might form the basis of a unifying notion of cyber law.
Is now, and by now I mean really, mid-2015, a particular inflection point that you think makes this an interesting question to tackle?
I think, for one thing, there's enough information, there has been enough legal movement to begin to see the contours of something. And for another thing, there have been very recently, very specific initiatives, spearheaded by governments in different parts of the world that target intermediaries. And as you said, that's a main focus of the book. And so a lot of the right to be forgotten developments that are going on in the European Union, all focused around search engines and people who handle other people's information, I think is a really significant touchstone. I think the whole debate about the Stop Online Piracy Act, and that was a couple of years back, and it was again very, very focused on intermediaries. I think the fact that courts and legislatures have really started to focus specifically on intermediaries in the last couple of years really tells us something about what's happening in this field.
Now, let me ask you, Jackie, because there are many listeners who are academics or students, but there's also others who may hear this discussion and think, here we go, there's two law professors discussing this abstract theoretical question of what cyber law is. What's your response to those who would say that this is a inside baseball discussion of minimal interest to people that aren't in the academic realm?
That in some ways that's a fair criticism. I mean, in some ways this is academic and it is theoretical and we are two law professors happily counting angels on a pinhead. I think in other ways people in the real world who are not academics or not even necessarily lawyers are also beginning to focus their attention on internet intermediaries. So when you, I keep going back to this right to be forgotten privacy issue in Europe, which has reverberated in the United States because it's this issue of, you know, if I have embarrassing information online and I want to get rid of it, who do I complain to? Who do I sue? And common everyday people in the street do go to Google and say, I don't want that to show up in the Google search results, or go to Facebook and say, I don't want Facebook to allow people to post, you know, allow my friends to post this stuff about me. So even though your average everyday people are not thinking about, gee, how do I conceptualize the contours of this very rarefied area of academic debate, they are thinking about their everyday interactions with online search engines, online shopping networks, online social networks, and that's really all part of this. That's what I'm observing, that people are, you know, your first port of call if you do anything online is what I would call an intermediary, a middleman, someone who handles information. They might not own the information, they might not themselves have generated the information, but they're handling information about people, or they're handling intellectual property, they're handling your music, and your, you know, everyone downloads their books now on Kindles and audiobooks and smartphones, and you know, it's no longer that you just go to the bookstore and buy a book. You deal with an intermediary, you deal with Amazon, you deal with Barnes and Noble online. So I think, you know, our day-to-day interactions are so much with what I would call an intermediary that it's hard to say, well, it's just an academic debate, because we all want to know what our rights and obligations are in terms of our dealings with these online companies.
So, Jackie, let's turn a bit before we delve into some of the themes of the book for those that aren't familiar. Cyber law sounds self-evident, but perhaps you could give us a historical definition of cyber law in terms of its scope and what a cyber lawyer would be.
Yeah, and that's always, as you mentioned earlier, that's always been a really tricky question, and it comes out, it's expressed, and again, this is a little academic, but what we call our law school courses and what we title the case books that we use to teach the courses. And you mentioned, you know, we sometimes say cyber law, we sometimes say cyberspace law, we sometimes say internet law. Information law is actually a broader term, but it encompasses a lot of what we deal with in cyber law. And I think the problem is that there's no really good term that defines what I'm talking about, which I guess makes this pretty academic. But when you say, well, what would a cyber lawyer be? What would a cyber lawyer look like? That's the big misnomer. And, you know, that was one of my concerns when these courses and these case books started appearing in the mid to late 1990s, that, you know, we had students coming to law school saying, I want to be a cyber lawyer. And there's no such thing as a cyber lawyer. I mean, what it means to, you know, colloquially, is people who deal with laws that affect what happens on initially the internet, and now I suppose all sorts of digital communications media, you know, iPods and smartphones and all that stuff. So really, if you're a lawyer and you do anything in the modern world, you're going to butt up against cyber law, because whatever you're dealing with, you're probably dealing with electronic transactions, you're probably dealing with, you know, sales and licensing and copyrights and trademarks and defamation and people complaining about employment issues where their employers have checked their Facebook page and found something out about them. So I certainly would say there's no such thing as a cyber lawyer, and I had to tell that to lots and lots and lots of students back around 2000 and in the years thereafter. And I think now people understand that really what it is what the field of cyber law is just looking at aspects of laws that touch on these digital communications media. So it's sort of skimming off the top. There's sales law, there's licensing law, and as soon as you do a sale or a license over a digital communications medium, there's a cyber component to it.
We're chatting with Jackie Lipton of Akron Law on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So let me, you're what the answer you just gave, Jackie, is a perfect segue into this question of the law of the horse. And for those that aren't familiar, I'll ask you to talk about it, or at least explain what that debate was. But it sounds to me, and this is my question for you, that what you just said sounds like maybe there's a bit of a law of the horse element to cyber law in 2015. What's your reaction to that question, first defining what this debate was?
Well, the law of the horse terminology, as you mentioned earlier, comes from a very famous in the field talk that Judge Frank Easterbrook gave at the University of Chicago around 1995-96. And he was actually asked to talk, I believe, about more to do with the law of property in cyberspace. And, you know, that was one thing that people were concerned about, intellectual property and protecting copyrights and trademarks and et cetera. And he just spoke more generally about internet law and the law of the horse. And he basically said, well, it doesn't make sense to create a whole legal field based on a thing like the internet, because that's like a whole legal field based on a horse. And you could create a field of study that is about horse racing and tortious problems that arise if a horse injures someone, and buying and selling horses, and you could create a whole field of law around it, but there would be no sort of cohesive, unifying, underlying theory to it. So in that sense, cyberspace law really is the law of the horse, because there's no underlying unifying theory to it. And that was the, you know, that's the criticism that everyone since 1996 has been responding to about internet law, cyberspace law. And there's a lot of possible responses to that concern, and many of them were raised at the time. So Lawrence Lessig very famously published an article, What the Law of the Horse Might Teach, and he talked about, well, you know, maybe Easterbrook's criticism is well-founded, but what cyberspace law really teaches us about is modes of regulation, different constraints on our behavior, and maybe law is only a part of that, and maybe software code is a much more significant part of that, and social norms and market forces affect how we interact, and maybe cyber law focuses our attention on the interaction between law and other modes of regulating human behavior. You know, another criticism of Easterbrook is to say, okay, well, fair enough, but we teach a lot of subjects that are law of the horse type subjects. I personally was a banking lawyer before I was a cyber lawyer or a teacher or whatever. Banking law is like that. It's a whole lot of tort and contract and privacy principles as they apply to banking operations. Insurance law is like that. Environmental law is like that. So it's not really, you know, a fatal criticism of a area of study to say it has these law of the horse-like components. What I've tried to do in this book, however, is go back and say, well, you know, maybe there is a comprehensive unifying basis for cyber law that maybe wasn't apparent in 1996 and is becoming more apparent now. And I've pinned it on this notion, as you mentioned, of really what unifies most of the issues that we consider in cyber law, particularly as teachers when we're teaching it, is everything that happens on the internet is basically a communication of some type. It's an interaction involving information, whether it's buying and selling or social networking or internet searching. It's always an information exchange. You're not doing anything physical. You can't commit assault and battery online. All you can do is exchange information online. You're not physically interacting with people in the same room. And it's always an intermediated information exchange, because I can't interact with you without there being a middleman that makes that possible. And there's all sorts of middlemen. There's the, you know, cable companies and the broadband companies that give us access to the internet, and there's the platforms over which we interact, like Facebook and MySpace, and when we buy stuff, Amazon, and when we look for information, Google and Bing. So I think what's become interesting to me is that if there's anything that's sort of unifying about it, it's that we're talking about laws that involve intermediated information exchanges, and those interactions have a lot of commonalities. And you mentioned a lot of them in your introduction, and a lot of them are things like, well, how much liability should the intermediary have as a primary participant in the communication? And when is it reasonable not to make someone liable? And what sort of precautions should an intermediary take to ensure that harmful communications aren't passing over their network, or that intellectual property rights aren't being infringed? So that's my attempt at answering Easterbrook's criticism and saying, well, here's what perhaps is a comprehensive, unifying, underlying idea to this field.
Jackie, let me ask you this as a follow-up, and I think as maybe an additional defense, if you will, of a cyber law field. And it moves us away from the law per se and really more into the policy arena. So I'm asking for your reaction to this. You know, you alluded to the Stop Online Piracy Act battles from a few years ago, and I was very active in opposing SOPA, largely on the grounds that you mentioned, and many other people were, but also we even have more recently and ongoing right now. Again, we're recording July 6th. We've got international trade negotiations theoretically going on where, from what we know, intellectual property issues involving these very questions of liability for intermediaries, among other issues involving access to medicine, which isn't as much a cyber law issue, are being negotiated. Is it fair to suggest that the cyber law field's value, getting back to that question about, you know, why non-academics should be interested, is not as much today about understanding the law as it is about having individuals, lawyers, in this case, who understand technology? Because one of the critiques that and concerns that I've had, and it's something, and I'm not veering this interview into my own writing, or I'd call this show the Dave Levine Show, but one of the concerns that I have ongoing is a lack of understanding at a fundamental level, not just among elected officials, but really among staffers, about technology. Is it fair? Could a cyber law field developed, as you're suggesting, be even perhaps more valuable to policymakers than it is to anyone else? So therefore, we have lawyers out there who simply understand what technology is and are able to translate technology and technological concepts in meaningful ways to policymakers. Is that fair to foist upon the cyber law field?
I think that's a really interesting question, and to some extent I would probably say the answer is yes, although, you know, I'd hate to say, well, you have to understand technology and the ins and outs of it to understand cyber law or to contribute to cyber law. And I think partly, I mean, one thing I do in the introduction of the book is I take a very content-based approach to cyber law. And I say there's a lot of technology underlying how information content exchanges work. And I've tended to not teach those so much in the cyber law course and see those more as part of, say, a telecommunications law course, because I think that there's a lot of policy that can be developed and a lot of law that can be drafted and a lot that can be understood about everyday human interactions online without necessarily having to understand the underlying technology. I think it is probably important, though, for those who are making policy and contributing to drafting legislation to understand the scope of the technology or the limitations of the technology, even if they don't understand the details of it. So to give an example, you know, in the European Union with the privacy debates there, what the European Court of Justice and really the European Parliament too have done is really put a huge burden on online intermediaries to safeguard individual privacy in a way that the technologies don't lend themselves to doing very well. And Google came out with a paper in, I think it was February this year, where they had some independent experts come in and talk about how really difficult it is when the policy makers dump an obligation on them that they're not really geared in terms of staffing and in terms of technology to deal with. And we've seen it in the United States too, in, you know, several of the leading copyright cases that have involved Google in the United States. Courts have considered the extent to which Google should be liable for copyright infringement as a search engine, like not as someone who's put up infringing information, but someone who's just helped access infringing information. And typically courts have, typically, not always, they've been fairly deferential to Google and often saying things like, well, as we understand the technology, we think Google's doing the best it can do and the benefits it provides to society outweigh the detriments to, say, the copyright holders. So I think perhaps the promotion of the understanding of the limitations of the technology is really important. I wouldn't go as far as saying, you know, we'd like this to be a field where it's incredibly technology focused, because I think that hinders the development of everyday people thinking about the reality of online interactions and the scope of them.
So we're chatting with Professor Jackie Lipton of Akron Law, author of the just released book, Rethinking Cyber Law, A New Vision for Internet Law, on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope to continue to listen to the show. So Jackie, let me go back to and just press a little bit further on, I think, this critical question. And I am, to be clear, asking this question in part as a law professor, recognizing that current, former, and perhaps even future law students who are interested in cyber law might be listening to the show. And this is a question that I get pretty much every time I teach internet law. You had mentioned in your previous answer that you would hate to suggest that you need to understand technology, or deeply understand technology, I think was probably implied, in order to make a contribution to the cyber law field. I agree with you. However, let me give you the pushback viewpoint and get your reaction to it. So, as I'm sure you've experienced as well, I've been at conferences where technologists, and by that I don't mean lawyers, but I mean computer science PhDs and other people who are deeply vested and versed in technology, bristle at lawyers showing up and coming up with ideas or remedies or concerns about technology that, in their views, aren't realistic or don't exist, or certainly at a minimum reflect a lack of understanding about technology. In my experience, I think that the ability for a lawyer to make a contribution in some of these fields is heavily dependent on being well-versed in technology. And a perfect example of this is the ongoing writing and concerns about the NSA's warrantless wiretapping and more of the internet. I've been places where technologists have basically said the lawyers are making suggestions about things that aren't happening, that don't happen, that can't happen, and their solutions, if there are any, don't fit what technology is actually capable of doing. What's your reaction to that, and is it fair to say that one's ability to make any contribution depends on that technological knowledge, or is there a separate role for non-technologically versed cyber lawyers in this realm?
Yeah, I mean, it is a difficult issue, and I think it may be a little bit dependent on the area. So, for example, you know, as you mentioned, my background is more the intellectual property area than some of the criminal aspects of online interaction or crimpro aspects. But, you know, a really good example of what you're talking about in intellectual property is the first sale debate in copyright, which is this idea mm-hmm. that, you know, in the real world, once you buy a hard copy of, you know, a book or a CD, you're allowed to sell it in a secondhand store, a secondhand market, without infringing copyright. And then we've had these services setting up online that try and mimic that, even though what you're really doing when you get music from Apple is you're licensing it rather than buying a copy. And then when these services like Redigi set up to allow a secondhand market to develop in digital music files, the content owners sue them and say, well, what you're really doing is deleting one copy and making another copy, and that's a copyright infringement. And the courts, the American courts so far, are agreeing with that. And I don't want to weigh in on whether I think those court decisions are correct or not correct, because I think there's arguments on both sides. But I do think the ability to really understand the technology and what it's doing would help there, an ability to sort of make analogies between, if there are analogies, between what's going on in the digital world and what's going on in the physical world. I know that I personally, when I started teaching cyber law, and I'm not suggesting everyone go out and do this, but I went and I did a sort of graduate certificate course in computer science, so I could just learn the basics of coding, I could learn the basics of how networks are set up, and, you know, I would not in any way describe myself as a computer scientist, but I just felt, you know, if I was going to talk about copyright in software code, I had to understand what code looked like and how it worked, and I think that's been a tremendous help. But certainly if I get into a higher level debate, you know, I'm completely lost. I only have a very basic understanding of the technology myself. And, you know, I'd love to say, well, gee, the problem would be solved if lawyers and technologists, computer scientists, whatever, worked really well together and listened to each other and understood. Sometimes it's very hard. They're just such different disciplines. And there is, as you say, there's this dynamic where the computer scientists often think, you know, the lawyers walk into the room and it's like, oh my God, these people are idiots. And, you know, the lawyers are there and they're like, but, you know, we just need a law that says this and then it'll be fine. It's like, no, that's not how the system works. Mm-hmm. So I think there can be a big disjoint, and I think it can affect very specific areas of legal development online. I think some areas, probably the technology specifically how the technology works isn't such a big deal. So I think maybe fair use in copyright law, we can develop notions of fair use without necessarily needing to know how the technology works. We can develop really notions of whether trademarks have been infringed or not with a fairly basic understanding of the technology. But I do think you're right that there probably are some areas where the technology is so specific and, you know, it's very difficult to get the lawyers to understand it. And that may be where a field of cyber law, as I conceptualize it, at least focuses attention on the idea that maybe this is one of those areas where the lawyers really need to sort of try and come to terms more with the technology than perhaps they have in the past.
It's, you know, it's one of these, and I'm going to move from this topic into some of the specific legal areas that you talk about in the book, you know, but certainly I think part of the challenge of being a cyber lawyer and or at least writing in the cyber law field, as you know, maybe cyber lawyer doesn't exist, is that to the extent that academics anyway are writing in this space, we have a very fairly narrow and truncated perspective of what scholarship fits into the boxes that allow for career advancement. And so as all, you know, as anyone who's written a while knows, you can think of articles that were very important to a particular field, and that's not just technology, of course, but so complex that it was difficult for editors to get their heads around. I mean, certainly cyber law could be an example of that, but I think a more classic example of the problem of placement and recognition broadly beyond a particular field occurs in areas like tax. But the point being that it seems to me that part of the challenge, which, I guess since I'm saying this, I invite you to react to it before we turn the corner, is that, you know, an emerging field, which I still contend that cyber law is emerging field, is difficult to fit into the traditional boxes that the most of the academic world operates in, whether it's because cyber law is interdisciplinary or because it is a nascent field. And such, the scholarship in that area tends to be a bit more truncated. In other words, to make this long-winded and somewhat convoluted statement clear, a lot of the pressure among the academic world is to write pieces that more neatly fit intellectual property. So you write a piece about the first sale doctrine, or you write a piece about access to medicine, as opposed to rethinking cyber law. I invite you to react, or you could simply say, we can move on.
No, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And actually, that's part of the reason I decided to write a book rather than I have written law review articles about this topic. But, yeah, and people who are listening who are not law professors, and, you know, tune out for the next 2 minutes if you're not. Yeah. No, don't tune out. Just keep listening or get a drink or something. But, I've been a little disenchanted with the sort of academic law review placement system, particularly in terms of this, you know, interdisciplinary work isn't always valued as much unless it's empirical work. And I think maybe 20, 30 years ago, the broader theoretical pieces were, I still think in some fields, broader theoretical pieces place well, and con law and maybe crim law is an example of that. But I do think the cyber law field, it's much easier to probably place an article that is dealing with a specific issue. And a lot of those specific issues do have enough meat to them that really is law review article size. But that's kind of why I wanted to write a book, because I've written law review articles about specific privacy issues and specific copyright issues and specific trademark issues and online governance. But I think when you're sort of looking at a field and putting together a whole lot of different aspects of the field to try and create some unifying force to it, I just felt a book overall was a better way of tackling this.
We're chatting with Jackie Lipton, author of the book Rethinking Cyber Law, A New Vision for Internet Law, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. All right, Jackie, so let's turn towards some of these broader legal questions that you discuss in the book. You note several times in the book that one of the recurring challenges in cyber law has been this balancing between innovation and promotion on one side, right? How do we use law to allow our inventors and innovators and creators to create on one side, and the protection of ownership rights on the other? This, of course, is a broad issue in intellectual property. Cyber law is, I think, a very important, maybe the most important piece of it. How has cyber law historically dealt with that balancing? Before I ask you towards the end of the show about where you think it should go.
Well, I think that there has been, it's hard to say this. I wanted to say I think there has been a trend towards promoting innovation, but it really does depend on the field that we're talking about. And certainly there's been a lot of saber rattling from copyright owners about protecting their rights online. There's a fantastic quote in the Supreme Court's opinion in the Grokster case from 2005-ish, which I cite in the copyright chapter in the book, where they talk about that balance between technology and technology, innovation, development, and protecting copyrights. And that's a fantastic case because that's the file sharing case. That was the service that came along after Napster and really before BitTorrent. And it was the case that really closed down Grokster and Streamcast and said, well, that's all illegal file sharing too. But it was one of those cases that everyone kind of knew what the Supreme Court had to do. I mean, they really had to say, you know, Grokster is an illegal file sharing service because they're just because courts had been saying that Napster was an illegal file sharing service. And the Grokster folks had coded their software around the legal reasoning in Napster. So, you know, technically, talking about how the technology actually worked, you know, the Grokster folks didn't have the kind of knowledge that they were required to have for a secondary copyright infringement, but we knew what the Supreme Court had to do. They had to look at that balance and shut it down and say this is consistent with the policy of, you know, promoting the copyright holders online. But, you know, we've seen a lot of recent cases, particularly involving Google, and the European privacy thing is a outlier here, where courts have said, oh, no, you know, Google's book digitizing is fair use and Google's use of thumbnail images of copyrighted pictures is fair use and, you know, educational uses of things are fair use. So it's funny, it seems to be there's a lot of things that the courts seem to be taking into account and they want to promote innovation, they want to promote legal rights in intellectual property. But if it's a service that's kind of known to be innovative and changing the way people deal with the world and access to information like Google, there seems to be more deference on the court's part than if it's Napster or Grokster or people who are seen to be just kind of taking rights away from copyright holders. So there's no there's no clear bright line rule. I think you can get clusters of cases. And like, for example, the music industry has been very, very successful at protecting their copyrights online with YouTube and all sorts of other services and Flickr and whatever. But the book industry has been, the publishing industry has been a lot less successful. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. But I think the cases of innovation versus protecting copyrights cluster in really interesting ways. So you can't really discern, you know, this value wins over this value, but in a particular cluster of cases, you can sort of predict it.
You know, I think, you know, the notion that innovation, encouragement, and ownership rights are always opposed, I think, is a fair point. It's not always the case. You know, you mentioned Grokster, and I took a look in your book, and I think the quote that you're referring to that you cited is the court pointed out, and this is the quote: "The more artistic protection is favored, the more technological innovation may be discouraged. The administration of copyright law is an exercise in managing the trade-off." So, you know, with that in mind, and I agree that that's a terrific quote, you know, a follow-up question there with regard to this balancing, and you kind of alluded to it there with Grokster, and I want to explore a little bit, you know, is for lack of a better phrase, the co-opting of existing markets. You know, if we delve into Grokster a little bit, and for listeners that weren't familiar, you know, this is, you know, the famous case involving the entity that in the sense was a in a very real sense was a successor to Napster that existed in the really what amounted to the heyday of peer-to-peer and peer-to-peer technology and was pretty heavily slammed by the Supreme Court for encouraging copyright infringement. One of the issues there, and this is kind of what I want to ask you, that the Grokster court got involved in was to suggest that the co-opting or the inheritance, if you will, of the existing Napster market, which was made up, according to the court, almost exclusively of people who were involved in copyright infringement or piracy, was itself a basis to hold Grokster liable. Do you think that internet law has dealt well with not the intermediaries, but with the consumers? Because while you could clearly, I think criticize Grokster and Napster's customers as being pirates, In a very real sense, they were also involved in the exchange of information in a nascent market where the law may have been clear, but its application, and I'm stating this fairly directly, may not have been. What's your take on cyber law and how it's dealt with consumers?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting question, because certainly, and I keep going back to copyright, because I think this is something that so many internet users relate to. I mean, we do deal with so much copyright information online. But this idea of the existing, producers, manufacturers, distributors, not necessarily seeing the potential of a market that someone else sees the potential of. And so, you know, those services, Napster and Grokster, jumped into this void before we had Apple, you know, before iTunes, before there was a sort of legal way of sharing music. And as you say, I mean, you know, Grokster is a peer-to-peer file sharing service. It can be used for things other than copyright infringement anyway. But it's been interesting that in the copyright area, American courts have been very, very aggressive about saying, look, you have to give the copyright holders time to develop these nascent markets, even if they haven't thought about it, which really puts the consumers at the mercy of what the markets want to do. And I think it probably takes longer for that to shake out than if nascent markets from independent people like Napster and Grokster were allowed to sort of compete, although I admit that, you know, maybe that does mean a lot of lost sales. I think we're beginning to see it in the publishing industry now, in the sort of the nascent commercial fan fiction market. And I wrote a piece on this in the Houston Law Review last year, where, you know, fan fiction has been traditionally non-commercial. People have just written it for fun. And now we've started seeing things like 50 Shades of Grey, which was, you know, initially Twilight fan fiction. And there are a number of fan fiction communities where, because of the cheap, easy self-publishing available online, you can quite easily make money off your fan fiction. And then Amazon last year set up the Kindle Worlds program, which allows licensed fan fiction of certain properties that it's licensed by the content holders to allow. So the question is, if there start being a lot of court cases about unauthorized fan fiction, are American courts going to say, no, that market is reserved to the copyright holders and there are legal ways of doing it through Amazon, so you can't just write your own commercial fan fiction? Or are they going to say, oh, no, that's fine, or it's fine if you maybe give a cut of your profits back to the copyright holders? So I think we're going to see a lot of this, and it's a really, really, really tough question, because a lot of it is making unauthorized use of other people's work. It involves making unauthorized use of other people's work. But by the same token, it gives consumers a lot more platforms for expression. It gives consumers a lot more platforms to get access to things in ways that they want to access them. And maybe it does spur on the copyright holders to create those markets. But yeah, I mean, it's just a very, very tough question. And it's an interesting exercise to think of, well, what would the world look like without copyright protection? You know, would we have more or less online innovation?
And there's, over the course of Hearsay Culture's nine-year run, I've had several guests on who have talked about a world without copyright from all perspectives, from economic perspectives with David K. Levine and Michele Boldrin, or even from theological perspectives, Marcus Boone writing about this by copyright as violating tenets of Buddhism. It's clearly not a sacrosanct concept that we need this ownership. And yet, I think getting back to this idea of rethinking cyber law, we are still working that through. We have a few minutes left. We're well into, Jackie, what I call, as you might recall, the unfair portion of the show, where I ask questions that you can't adequately address in the time that we have left, at least by my standards or yours, but then I ask them anyway. I don't think you can have a cyber law discussion, particularly one that lasts as long as this one does, without mentioning and discussing briefly at least Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act. There have been conferences around Section 230, which we have discussed on the show before, but for those that may not have heard those shows and don't recall, is a portion of federal law that effectively shields speech platforms like Google and Facebook and the like from claims or liability involving things like defamation. That's a very simplified statement, and there are ways to actually get them dinged, but generally that's the concept. Do you view Section 230 as the paradigmatic example of a cyber law? In other words, I'm asking what I think is a bit sounds like a kind of question you'd ask in a bar or something like that. I'm not asking what your favorite cyber law is, but when I think about what is the cyber law field and what law would exemplify it, I think of Section 230. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think it exemplifies my approach in the book, which is saying, well, cyber law is the law of the internet intermediary, because Section 230 is the law of the internet intermediary. It basically says very clearly that if you are not the speaker of the content, that you are not liable for the content that goes through your network. And as you say, there are situations where you are liable if you've had something to do with the generation of the content. But I think it is, I agree with you, it's the paradigmatic example of Congress turning their mind to something that happens on the internet. It's much broader than just intellectual property, and in fact it carves out intellectual property for the most part, as you know. And it's had a huge impact on the way people interact online. It has avoided chilling effects that may otherwise have come along if there were a lot of successful defamation and privacy, and it causes its own problems too. But I think it is the paradigmatic cyber law.
So, Jackie, in the last couple minutes we have here, I want to kind of ask you, I'm not asking you for a crystal ball, but I am asking for a little bit of futuristic thinking, if you will. There have been a few scholars who have said or written or implied, probably a better way to put it, that cyber law has had its day, that cyber law as a field is receding. And I don't mean, I want to move beyond academics, just generally speaking, and that areas like robotics, for example, are the new cyber law. What's your take on the state of cyber law today, and then where do you see it going in the short term, let's say in the next 5 years?
Well, I don't agree that cyber law has had its day in the sense of it's kind of dying off. I think certainly what we see in classrooms is, back in the 90s, there was this huge all the waiting lists, huge surge of interest in it. And I think that tapered off. And we now see at law schools very steady classes in terms of the cases coming out of courts, a steady amount of cases, about these kinds of issues. So I think, we had this huge groundswell and, great fanfare, and now it's stabilized, I think, into, this is what it is. So I think it will continue. It's not like, the law of electricity at the last millennium, where there were textbooks on that, and you don't really need a law of electricity. I think we do probably need a law about how we interact online. In terms of where it might go, and you said earlier, you described it as a still emerging field. I think it is, and I'm interested in this thing about the law of robotics and AI and all of that stuff, because, that may end up being a part of cyber law too, a significant amount of it. I'm presupposing intermediaries intermediating two or more primary human communicators, but increasingly there's going to be, we already have bots who interact for us online. So I think there's going to be an interesting interaction between robotics, artificial intelligence, and cyber law. And I'll probably have to come back in another 15 or 20 years and rethink my rethinking of cyber law.
At which time, hopefully, I'll, you know, who knows where the show will be at that point. I certainly invite you back in 15 to 20 years.
You'll be a robot.
I'm about to say it could all be over for us. I mean, if robots, you know, become the overlords, as people are starting to predict. Well, Jackie Lipton, author of the book Rethinking Cyber Law, A New Vision for Internet Law, recently published by Elgar Publishing. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. You know, as I mentioned, beginning teaching internet law, I'm now thinking through how to incorporate what I think is a very useful and thoughtful contribution to our understanding of the field. Thank you for joining us on the show. Of course, you're always welcome back, and I look forward to continuing this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
There's a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture. You know, this quarter is one that, as I mentioned in my posting of the schedule a few weeks ago, is a bit truncated, and it's truncated because, as I said in a somewhat tongue-in-cheek but very real manner, law review articles don't write themselves. And as much as I love doing the show, else I wouldn't do it, I also sometimes have to carve out time. Summers, so we've had a lot of academic discussion today, which is not a bad thing, but I like to vary things. But I'll add this, since for those that aren't familiar, there's a general colloquial view that law professors take the summer off. At least those professors that write, that the summer is for that. And so that's what I tend to do over the summers. As a result, I'm going to do a few fewer shows this summer and put that time towards projects that I'm currently working on. Coming up this quarter are several terrific guests. Among those that will be appearing are Professor Natasha Schull of MIT, author of Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas, as well as Professor Margot Kaminsky of the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law on International Trade, Surveillance, and Artificial Intelligence, and Lorelei Kelly of the New America Foundation on Technology and Legislative Decision Making. I'm also in the process of booking guests for the fall, which begins roughly in September. There's a lot of people have already started to book, and you can find that list of future guests by going to hearsayculture.com. This quarter, you can hear Hearsay Culture Fridays at 3 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU by streaming us at kzsulive.stanford.edu or listening in the Bay Area. As always, you can also listen to the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all the previous 230-plus shows as well as the future shows. Also, I'm happy to say that the show is now available on the Stitcher podcast app, so you can find it there as well, or by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet and Society, or by going to the webpage for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com or by going to the contact link at the Hearsay Culture webpage. So feel free to reach out to me with any comments, suggestions, feedback, and the like. And the last thing I will say, by way of a logistical note, I've gotten some feedback with regard to the embedded player that exists on the Hearsay Culture website. I recognize that there are some bugs to it. Occasionally, apparently, people are having it suddenly stop and then not be able to rewind. I can imagine how frustrating it is. Although I'm happy to have you listen to the show multiple times, that's probably not what you want to do with your time. So I am in the process of looking at alternatives. I will note, however, you can, in the interim, click the download link on the page, and therefore it should open up the file that you want to listen to in a separate browser that won't have that issue. At any rate, I'm on top of it, and I thank listeners for the feedback on that front. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.